This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Hard Times, written by Charles Dickens, performed by Bertie Carvel.
Introduction, written and read by Jeremy Paxman. There will soon doubtless come a time when no one reads the greatest of English novelists. His books can already seem too long for our short attention spans, his language too ornamental for the age of 140 character wisdom, and there's certainly not enough bang-bang of any sort. But he remains the greatest, even though much of the literary establishment has been taking him for granted for decades. I was even able to get a decent degree in English from Cambridge without having read a single one of his novels, and that was back in the 1970s. Professors of literature find him too easy to dismiss as a hack who knew how to play the public with an awful weakness for sentimentality. Ours is a worldly age, hard and knowing. Taste is determined by the critical counterparts of Newcastle teenagers club-crawling on a freezing January night. Charles Dickens knows when to bring in a death or a dog to play on the reader's heart, and we know why he's doing it, and we don't care for it. But let's be realistic. All novelists are hacks. Those who can make a living from their books, and those who can't, aspire to be able to do so. As Dr. Johnson remarked, no man but a blockhead ever wrote except for money. Where is the crime in the fact that Charles Dickens made himself comfortably off by feeding the appetite of the English-speaking world for stories? Hard Times was written as a serial to boost the flagging fortunes of his weekly magazine, Household Words. Does the fact that it was written for a tuppenny magazine somehow make the thing worthless? All novels are mere pleasure. Of all Dickens's fiction, Hard Times is my favourite. It may not contain anyone as terrifying as the escaped convict Magwitch of Great Expectations. There are no memorable thugs like Bill Sykes and Oliver Twist. No jolly fat philanthropists like the Cheerable brothers in Nicholas Nickleby. No sugary object of pity like little Nell in the old curiosity shop. Charles Dickens's playfulness with names is there in walk-on parts, like the teacher Mr. Chokemchild and the bank porter Bitzer, and there are still a few soppy characters in Hard Times. Personally, I find Sissy Jupe a bit much. But there is something more workaday about most of the individuals in Hard Times than in many other novels. Perhaps it comes from the setting. Dickens's London novels are much more precisely located, and Coketown, the biggest character in the book, is a more murky, oppressive presence than anything else. Britain had long ago become the first country in the world where a majority of the population lived in towns and cities, as a consequence of the Industrial Revolution, and at the time of Dickens's novel, Manchester had a population of between 300,000 and 400,000 people. My own ancestors were among them, shipped there on an extraordinary canal barge scheme to take unemployed peasants from Suffolk to tend the machines of the northern mill towns, which had developed to exploit new technologies and to manufacture goods sold worldwide. In the 50 years before the publication of Hard Times, Manchester's population had quadrupled. Dickens, though, was a southerner and didn't know the north well. Coketown seems to have been influenced by a visit he made to Preston in January 1854, when the town was in the grip of a strike and employers' lockout, after mill workers withdrew their labour demanding a pay rise. Preston had been a small market town at the turn of the 19th century, but by 1851, its population had quintupled. Completely by chance, in 1732, a baby christened Richard Arkwright had been born, the youngest of 13 children of a struggling tailor there. Richard Arkwright's adult invention, or plagiarizing of ideas for a powered machine for spinning yarn, made him the father of the modern factory system. Coketown is a mill town, and like most mill towns, it exists solely for practical reasons. Commerce has made the place into a fire and brimstone-breathing monster. There seems to be nothing there but languid and monotonous smoke, says Mr. Gradgrind's frightened daughter, Louisa, looking down on the town from their middle-class villa. Yet when the night comes, fire bursts out, Father, she said. Oddly, and this will ring true to anyone who's spent time among the remnants of British manufacturing, the dominant feeling in Coketown is of cold and damp. It's choking atmosphere, coughing out the lives of the town's mill workers. At the time of his daughter's observation, the night-day comparison discloses the shudder she feels at her father's notion of marriage to the local mill owner, Mr. Bounderby. Mr. Gradgrind, with his teeth-gritting, alliterative name and miserablest approach to education, "Now, what I want is facts. Teach these boys and girls nothing but facts," he says right at the start of the book. He's an unattractive enough character. Now he wants to see her married off to an insufferable professional northerner, Josiah Bounderby. Bounderby is full of what Dickens calls braggart humility, and sounds as if he's just walked out of that Monty Python sketch about growing up in a shoebox in the middle of the road. Louisa Gradgrind's day-night smoke-fire observation surely reveals her horror at the prospect of sharing a bed with the old bore. And then there's Bounderby's snotty, thin-lipped old bag of a housemate, Mrs. Sparsit. You wouldn't want to spend any time with any of them. Against this unsympathetic gang who know the cost of everything and the value of nothing, Dickens sets out a range of individuals whose humane instincts reflect the possibility of nobility among the cacodemons of the smoking chimneys. The young Louisa and her brother sneak off one afternoon to watch Sleary's Circus, a touring ensemble of show people. Louisa has been taught that a horse is a graminivorous quadruped with 40 teeth, namely 20 grinders, 4 eye teeth, and 12 incisive. Sheds coat in the spring in marshy countries. Sheds hoofs, too, hooves hard but requiring to be shod with iron. As Dickens himself interjects later, no little Gradgrind had ever associated a cow in a field with that famous cow with the crumpled horn who tossed the dog that worried the cat, that killed the rat that ate the malt, and had only been introduced to a cow as a graminivorous ruminating quadruped with several stomachs. At the circus, we and the Gradgrind children are introduced to acrobats and clowns whose way of life is built upon circus master Sleary's belief that no one can live by facts alone. Everyone needs to be thrilled and amused. Inevitably, there's a dancing dog, Merrylegs. The novel is generally seen as an attack by Charles Dickens on utilitarianism, the philosophy propounded by Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill, which holds that the value of thoughts and actions can only be judged by the extent to which they promote the greatest good for the greatest number. This has always struck me as a flawed approach to life, since it critically depends upon who is defining what is either the greatest good or the greatest number, and leaves the door ajar to totalitarianism. That is no problem for its supposed exemplars in the book, Gradgrind and Bounderby, who come across as two of the most self-important prigs ever to have darkened a page of fiction. Judgment, condemnation in particular, is second nature to them. The characters who people these pages, attempting to grapple with the real stuff of life, love, ambition, illness, dependency, vindictiveness, loveless marriages are, of course, those with whom we sympathize. Dickens was nothing if not gloriously human. There are scenes and characters who could have come straight from soap opera, like poor Stephen Blackpool, trapped in a meaningless marriage with an alcoholic and consequently unable to be with the woman he loves. Framed for a bank robbery, he dies after falling down into a disused mine called the old hell shaft. Let's not expect Dickens to miss the obvious. He was a showman, which means he was something of a charlatan. It's a chicken-and-egg conundrum. Did Dickens play upon our heartstrings because he instinctively understood how humans feel, Or do we feel as we do because he gives us no alternative? Who do you prefer as your guide, Jeremy Bentham or Charles Dickens? Bentham was unblinking, yet vain enough to have his body preserved in a glass case at University College London. Dickens was vain and romantic. He wanted to be buried cheaply, quietly, and unshowily. That he ended up in Poet's Corner at Westminster Abbey wasn't his fault. Dickens's popularity was built on his instinct for humanity, the fact that he prized people and feelings over the dead calculations of the scientists and entrepreneurs who were remaking Victorian Britain. Early in the book, he summarizes the mill owner's attitude. So many hands, workers in this mill, so many 100-horse steam power. It is known to the force of a single pound weight what the engine will do, but not all the calculators of the national debt can tell me the capacity for good or evil, for love or hatred, for patriotism or discontent, for the decomposition of virtue into vice, or the reverse, at any single moment in the soul of one of these its quiet servants with the composed faces and the regulated actions. Hard Times is a wonderful novel, and if it's moral that there is much, much more to life than reciting facts and looking after number one, that not everything can be weighed and measured, is hardly revolutionary, it's nonetheless life-affirming. Some of the tying up of loose ends in the conclusion is unsatisfactory, even with the pleasure of seeing Gradgrind as the biter bit. Overall, though, unlike some of Dickens's novels, you don't feel you're being manipulated. It's a novel you feel better for having absorbed. And be sure not to miss the splendid editorial digs like Dickens's description of Gradgrind's work in Westminster after he's become an MP. Sifting, sifting at his parliamentary cinder heap in London, without being observed to turn up many precious articles among the rubbish. By the end of the book, even Gradgrind is a sadder, wiser man and a redeemed human being. But I've gone on long enough. It's a terrific book, and I hope you enjoy it.
Book the First. Sewing. Chapter 1. The One Thing Needful. Now what I want is facts. Teach these boys and girls nothing but facts. Facts alone are wanted in life. Plant nothing else and root out everything else. You can only form the minds of reasoning animals upon facts. Nothing else will ever be of any service to them. This is the principle on which I bring up my own children, and this is the principle on which I bring up these children. Stick to facts, sir. The scene was a plain, bare, monotonous vault of a schoolroom, and the speaker's square forefinger emphasized his observations by underscoring every sentence with a line on the schoolmaster's sleeve. The emphasis was helped by the speaker's square wall of a forehead, which had his eyebrows for its base, while his eyes found commodious cellarage in two dark caves overshadowed by the wall. The emphasis was helped by the speaker's mouth, which was wide, thin, and hard-set. The emphasis was helped by the speaker's voice, which was inflexible, dry, and dictatorial. The emphasis was helped by the speaker's hair, which bristled on the skirts of his bald head, a plantation of furs to keep the wind from its shining surface, all covered with knobs, like the crust of a plum pie, as if the head had scarcely warehouse room for the hard facts stored inside. The speaker's obstinate carriage, square coat, square legs, square shoulders, nay, his very neckcloth, trained to take him by the throat with an unaccommodating grasp, like a stubborn fact as it was, all helped the emphasis. In this life, we want nothing but facts, sir. Nothing but facts. The speaker and the schoolmaster and the third grown person present all backed a little, and swept with their eyes the inclined plane of little vessels then and there arranged in order, ready to have imperial gallons of facts poured into them until they were full to the brim. Chapter 2. Murdering the Innocents. Thomas Gradgrind, sir, a man of realities, a man of facts and calculations, A man who proceeds upon the principle that two and two are four and nothing over, and who is not to be talked into allowing for anything over. Thomas Gradgrind, sir, peremptorily Thomas, Thomas Gradgrind. With a rule and a pair of scales and the multiplication table always in his pocket, sir, ready to weigh and measure any parcel of human nature and tell you exactly what it comes to. It is a mere question of figures, a case of simple arithmetic. You might hope to get some other nonsensical belief into the head of George Gradgrind, or Augustus Gradgrind, or John Gradgrind, or Joseph Gradgrind, all supposititious, non-existent persons, but into the head of Thomas Gradgrind, no, sir. In such terms, Mr. Gradgrind always mentally introduced himself, whether to his private circle of acquaintance or to the public in general. In such terms, no doubt substituting the words boys and girls for sir, Thomas Gradgrind now presented Thomas Gradgrind to the little pitchers before him, who were to be filled so full of facts. Indeed, as he eagerly sparkled at them from the cellarage before mentioned, he seemed a kind of cannon, loaded to the muzzle with facts, and prepared to blow them clean out of the regions of childhood at one discharge. He seemed a galvanizing apparatus, too, charged with a grim mechanical substitute for the tender young imaginations that were to be stormed away. "Girl number 20," said Mr. Gradgrind, squarely pointing with his square forefinger. "I don't know that girl. Who is that girl?"
"Sissy Jupe, sir," explained number 20, blushing, standing up and curtsying.
"Sissy is not a name," said Mr. Gradgrind. "Don't call yourself Sissy. Call yourself Cecilia."
"It's father as calls me Sissy, sir," returned the young girl in a trembling voice and with another curtsy.
"Then he has no business to do it," said Mr. Gradgrind. "Tell him he mustn't. Cecilia Jupe. Let me see. What is your father?"
"He belongs to the horse riding, if you please, sir."
Mr. Gradgrind frowned and waved off the objectionable calling with his hand.
"We don't want to know anything about that here. You mustn't tell us about that here. Your father breaks horses, don't he?"
"If you please, sir, when they can get any to break, they do break horses in the ring, sir."
"You mustn't tell us about the ring here."
"Very well, then. Describe your father as a horse breaker."
"He doctors sick horses, I dare say."
"Oh, yes, sir."
"Very well, then. He is a veterinary surgeon, a farrier, and horse breaker. Give me your definition of a horse."
Sissy Jupe, thrown into the greatest alarm by this demand.
"Girl number 20, unable to define a horse," said Mr. Gradgrind for the general behoof of all the little pitchers. "Girl number 20, possessed of no facts in reference to one of the commonest of animals. Some boy's definition of a horse. Bitzer, yours."
The square finger moving here and there lighted suddenly on Bitzer, perhaps because he chanced to sit in the same ray of sunlight which, darting in at one of the bare windows of the intensely whitewashed room, irradiated Sissy. For the boys and girls sat on the face of the inclined plane, in two compact bodies, divided up the centre by a narrow interval, and Sissy, being at the corner of a row on the sunny side, came in for the beginning of a sunbeam of which Bitzer, being at the corner of a row on the other side, a few rows in advance, caught the end. But whereas the girl was so dark-eyed and dark-haired that she seemed to receive a deeper and more lustrous colour from the sun when it shone upon her, the boy was so light-eyed and light-haired that the self-same rays appeared to draw out of him what little colour he ever possessed. His cold eyes would hardly have been eyes, but for the short ends of lashes which, by bringing them into immediate contrast with something paler than themselves, expressed their form. His short-cropped hair might have been a mere continuation of the sandy freckles on his forehead and face. His skin was so unwholesomely deficient in the natural tinge that he looked as though, if he were cut, he would bleed white.
"Bitzer," said Thomas Gradgrind, "your definition of a horse?"
"Quadruped, graminivorous. 40 teeth, namely 24 grinders, 4 eye teeth and 12 incisive. Sheds coat in the spring. In marshy countries sheds hoofs too. Hoofs hard but requiring to be shod with iron. Age known by marks in mouth."
Thus and much more, Bitzer.
"Now, girl number 20,
said Mr. Gradgrind. "You know what a horse is." She curtsied again, and would have blushed deeper if she could have blushed deeper than she had blushed all this time. Bitzer, after rapidly blinking at Thomas Gradgrind with both eyes at once, and so catching the light upon his quivering ends of lashes that they looked like the antennae of busy insects, put his knuckles to his freckled forehead and sat down again. The third gentleman now stepped forth. A mighty man at cutting and drying he was, a government officer in his way, and in most other people's too, a professed pugilist, always in training, always with a system to force down the general throat like a bolus, always to be heard of at the bar of his little public office, ready to fight all England. To continue in fistic phraseology, he had a genius for coming up to the scratch, wherever and whatever it was, and proving himself an ugly customer. He would go in and damage any subject whatever with his right, follow up with his left, stop, exchange, counter, bore his opponent, he always fought all England, to the ropes, and fall upon him neatly. He was certain to knock the wind out of common sense and render that unlucky adversary deaf to the call of time. And he had it in charge from high authority to bring about the great public office millennium when commissioners should reign upon earth.
"Very well," said this gentleman, briskly smiling and folding his arms. "That's a horse. Now, let me ask you, girls and boys, would you paper a room with representations of horses?"
After a pause, one half of the children cried in chorus, "Yes, sir," upon which the other half, seeing in the gentleman's face that yes was wrong, cried out in chorus, "No, sir," as the custom is in these examinations.
"Of course no. Why wouldn't you?"
A pause. One corpulent, slow boy with a wheezy manner of breathing ventured the answer, "Because he wouldn't paper a room at all, but would paint it."
"You must paper it," said the gentleman, rather warmly.
"You must paper it," said Thomas Gradgrind, "whether you like it or not. Don't tell us you wouldn't paper it. What do you mean, boy?"
"I'll explain to you, then," said the gentleman, after another and a dismal pause, "why you wouldn't paper a room with representations of horses. Do you ever see horses walking up and down the sides of rooms in reality? In fact, do you?"
"Yes, sir,"
from one half.
"No, sir,"
from the other.
"Of course no," said the gentleman, with an indignant look at the wrong half. "Why, then, you are not to see anywhere what you don't see in fact. You are not to have anywhere what you don't have in fact. What is called taste is only another name for fact."
Thomas Gradgrind nodded his approbation.
"This is a new principle, a discovery, a great discovery," said the gentleman. "Now, I'll try you again. Suppose you were going to carpet a room. Would you use a carpet having a representation of flowers upon it?"
There being a general conviction by this time that "no, sir," was always the right answer to this gentleman, the chorus of "no" was very strong. Only a few feeble stragglers said "yes," among them Sissy Jupe.
"Girl number 20, said the gentleman, smiling in the calm strength of knowledge.
Sissy blushed and stood up.
"So, you would carpet your room, or your husband's room, if you were a grown woman and had a husband, with representations of flowers, would you?" said the gentleman. "Why would you?"
"If you please, sir, I'm very fond of flowers," returned the girl.
"And is that why you would put tables and chairs upon them and have people walking over them with heavy boots?"
"It wouldn't hurt them, sir. They wouldn't crush and wither, if you please, sir. They would be the pictures of what was very pretty and pleasant, and I would fancy—"
Aye, but you mustn't fancy," cried the gentleman, quite elated by coming so happily to his point. "That's it. You are never to fancy."
"You are not, Cecilia Jupe," Thomas Gradgrind solemnly repeated, "to do anything of that kind."
"Fact, fact, fact," said the gentleman.
And "fact, fact, fact," repeated Thomas Gradgrind.
"You are to be in all things regulated and governed," said the gentleman, "by fact. We hope to have before long a board of fact, composed of commissioners of fact, who will force the people to be a people of fact, and of nothing but fact.
You must discard the word fancy altogether. You have nothing to do with it.
You are not to have in any object of use or ornament what would be a contradiction in fact.
You don't walk upon flowers in fact.
You cannot be allowed to walk upon flowers in carpets. You don't find that foreign birds and butterflies come and perch upon your crockery. You cannot be permitted to paint foreign birds and butterflies upon your crockery. You never meet with quadrupeds going up and down walls. You must not have quadrupeds represented upon walls.
You must use, said the gentleman, for all these purposes, combinations and modifications in primary colours of mathematical figures which are susceptible of proof and demonstration. This is the new discovery. This is fact. This is taste.
The girl curtsied and sat down. She was very young, and she looked as if she were frightened by the matter-of-fact prospect the world afforded.
Now, if Mr. Machocum Child, said the gentleman, will proceed to give his first lesson here, Mr. Gradgrind, I shall be happy, at your request, to observe his mode of procedure.
Mr. Gradgrind was much obliged.
Mr. Machocum Child, we wait only for you.
So, Mr. Machocum Child began in his best manner. He and some 140 other schoolmasters had been lately turned at the same time in the same factory, on the same principles, like so many pianoforte legs. He had been put through an immense variety of paces, and had answered volumes of head-breaking questions, orthography, etymology, syntax and prosody, biography, astronomy, geography and general cosmography, the sciences of compound proportion, algebra, land surveying and levelling, vocal music and drawing from models were all at the ends of his 10 chilled fingers. He had worked his stony way into Her Majesty's Most Honourable Privy Council's Schedule B, and had taken the bloom off the higher branches of mathematics and physical science, French, German, Latin and Greek. He knew all about all the watersheds of all the world, whatever they are, and all the histories of all the peoples, and all the names of all the rivers and mountains, and all the productions, manners, and customs of all the countries, and all their boundaries and bearings on the 32 points of the compass. Ah, rather overdone, Machocum Child. If he had only learnt a little less, how infinitely better he might have taught much more. He went to work in this preparatory lesson not unlike Morgiana in The 40 Thieves, looking into all the vessels ranged before him one after another to see what they contained. Say, good Machocum Child, when from thy boiling store thou shalt fill each jar brimful by and by, dost thou think that thou wilt always kill outright the robber fancy lurking within, or sometimes only maim him and distort him?
Chapter 3. A Loophole. Mr. Gradgrind walked homeward from the school in a state of considerable satisfaction. It was his school, and he intended it to be a model. He intended every child in it to be a model, just as the young Gradgrinds were all models. There were 5 young Gradgrinds, and they were models every one. They had been lectured at from their tenderest years, coursed like little hares. Almost as soon as they could run alone, they had been made to run to the lecture room. The first object with which they had an association, or of which they had a remembrance, was a large blackboard with a dry ogre chalking ghastly white figures on it. Not that they knew by name or nature anything about an ogre. Fact forbid. I only use the word to express a monster in a lecturing castle, with heaven knows how many heads manipulated into one, taking childhood captive and dragging it into gloomy statistical dens by the hair. No little Gradgrind had ever seen a face in the moon. It was up in the moon before it could speak distinctly. No little Gradgrind had ever learnt the silly jingle, "Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are." No little Gradgrind had ever known wonder on the subject, each little Gradgrind having at 5 years old dissected the great bear like a Professor Owen, and driven Charles's Wain like a locomotive engine driver. no little Gradgrind had ever associated a cow in a field with that famous cow with a crumpled horn, who tossed the dog, who worried the cat, who killed the rat, who ate the malt, or with that yet more famous cow who swallowed Tom Thumb. It had never heard of those celebrities, and had only been introduced to a cow as a graminivorous, ruminating quadruped with several stomachs. To his matter-of-fact home, which was called Stone Lodge, Mr. Gradgrind directed his steps. He had virtually retired from the wholesale hardware trade before he built Stone Lodge, and was now looking about for a suitable opportunity of making an arithmetical figure in Parliament. Stone Lodge was situated on a moor, within a mile or two of a great town called Coketown, in the present faithful guidebook. A very regular feature on the face of the country, Stone Lodge was, not the least disguised, toned down or shaded off that uncompromising fact in the landscape. A great square house with a heavy portico darkening the principal windows, as its master's heavy brows overshadowed his eyes. A calculated, cast-up, balanced, and proved house. 6 windows on this side of the door, 6 on that side. A total of 12 in this wing, a total of 12 in the other wing. 24 carried over to the back wings. A lawn and garden and an infant avenue all ruled straight like a botanical account book. Gas and ventilation, drainage and water service, all of the primest quality. Iron clamps and girders, fireproof from top to bottom. Mechanical lifts for the housemaids, with all their brushes and brooms. Everything that heart could desire. Everything, well, I suppose, sir. The little Gradgrinds had cabinets in various departments of science, too. They had a little conchological cabinet, and a little metallurgical cabinet, and a little mineralogical cabinet. And the specimens were all arranged and labelled, and the bits of stone and ore looked as though they might have been broken from the parent substances by those tremendously hard instruments their own names. And to paraphrase the idle legend of Peter Piper, who had never found his way into their nursery, if the greedy little Gradgrinds grasped at more than this, what was it for good gracious goodness sake that the greedy little Gradgrinds grasped it? Their father walked on in a hopeful and satisfied frame of mind. He was an affectionate father, after his manner, but he would probably have described himself, if he had been put like Sissy Jupe upon a definition, as an eminently practical father. He had a particular pride in the phrase eminently practical, which was considered to have a special application to him. Whatsoever the public meeting held in Coketown, and whatsoever the subject of such a meeting, some Coketowner was sure to seize the occasion of alluding to his eminently practical friend, Gradgrind. This always pleased the eminently practical friend. He knew it to be his due, but his due was acceptable. He had reached the neutral ground upon the outskirts of town, which was neither town nor country, and yet was either spoiled, when his ears were invaded by the sound of music. The clashing and banging band attached to the horse-riding establishment, which had there set up its rest in a wooden pavilion, was in full bray. A flag floating from the summit of the temple proclaimed to mankind that it was Sleary's horse-riding which claimed their suffrages. Sleary himself, a stout modern statue with a money-box at its elbow, in an ecclesiastical niche of early Gothic architecture, took the money. Miss Josephine Sleary, as some very long and very narrow strips of printed bill announced, was then inaugurating the entertainments with her graceful equestrian Tyrolean flower act. Among the other pleasing but always strictly moral wonders which must be seen to be believed, Signor Jupe was that afternoon to elucidate the diverting accomplishments of his highly trained performing dog Merrylegs. He was also to exhibit his astounding feat of throwing 7,500 in rapid succession backhanded over his head, thus forming a fountain of solid iron in mid-air, a feat never before attempted in this or any other country, and which, having elicited such rapturous plaudits from enthusiastic throngs, it cannot be withdrawn. The same Signor Jupe was to enliven the varied performances at frequent intervals with his chaste Shakespearean quips and retorts. Lastly, he was to wind them up by appearing in his favourite character of Mr. William Button of Tooley Street, in the highly novel and laughable Hippo Comedietta of The Tailor's Journey to Brentford. Thomas Gradgrind took no heed of these trivialities, of course, but passed on as a practical man ought to pass on, either brushing the noisy insects from his thoughts or consigning them to the House of Correction. But the turning of the road took him by the back of the booth, and at the back of the booth a number of children were congregated in a number of stealthy attitudes, striving to peep in at the hidden glories of the place. This brought him to a stop. "Now to think of these vagabonds," said he, "attracting the young rabble from a model school." A space of stunted grass and dry rubbish being between him and the young rabble, he took his eyeglass out of his waistcoat to look for any child he knew by name and might order off. Phenomenon almost incredible, though distinctly seen, what did he then behold but his own metallurgical Louisa, peeping with all her might through a hole in a deal board, and his own mathematical Thomas, abasing himself on the ground to catch but a hoof of the graceful equestrian Tyrolean flower act. Dumb with amazement, Mr. Gradgrind crossed to the spot where his family was thus disgraced, laid his hand upon each erring child, and said, "Louisa, Thomas." Both rose, red and disconcerted. But Louisa looked at her father with more boldness than Thomas did. Indeed, Thomas did not look at him, but gave himself up to be taken home like a machine. "In the name of wonder, idleness, and folly," said Mr. Gradgrind, leading each away by a hand, "what do you do here?"
"Wanted to see what it was like," returned Louisa shortly.
"What it was like?"
"Yes, father." There was an air of jaded sullenness in them both, and particularly in the girl. Yet struggling through the dissatisfaction of her face, there was a light with nothing to rest upon, a fire with nothing to burn, a starved imagination keeping life in itself somehow, which brightened its expression. Not with the brightness natural to cheerful youth, but with uncertain, eager, doubtful flashes, which had something painful in them, analogous to the changes on a blind face groping its way. She was a child now, of 15 or 16, but at no distant day would seem to become a woman all at once. Her father thought so as he looked at her. She was pretty, would have been self-willed, he thought in his eminently practical way, but for her bringing up. "Thomas, though I have the fact before me, I find it difficult to believe that you, with your education and resources, should have brought your sister to a scene like this."
"I brought him, father," said Louisa quickly. "I asked him to come."
"I am sorry to hear it.
I am very sorry indeed to hear it. It makes Thomas no better, and it makes you worse, Louisa."
She looked at her father again, but no tear fell down her cheek.
"You, Thomas, and you, to whom the circle of the sciences is open. Thomas and you, who may be said to be replete with facts. Thomas and you, who have been trained to mathematical exactness. Thomas and you, here," cried Mr. Gradgrind, "in this degraded position. I am amazed."
"I was tired, father. I have been tired a long time," said Louisa.
"Tired of what?" asked the astonished father.
"I don't know of what. Of everything, I think."
"Say not another word," returned Mr. Gradgrind. "You are childish. I will hear no more."
He did not speak again until they had walked some half a mile in silence, when he gravely broke out with,
"What would your best friend say, Louisa? Do you attach no value to their good opinion? What would Mr. Bounderby say?"
At the mention of this name, his daughter stole a look at him, remarkable for its intense and searching character. He saw nothing of it, for before he looked at her she had again cast down her eyes.
"What," he repeated presently, "would Mr. Bounderby say?"
All the way to Stone Lodge, as with grave indignation he led the two delinquents home, he repeated at intervals,
"What would Mr. Bounderby say?"
As if Mr. Bounderby had been Mrs. Grundy.
Chapter 4. Mr. Bounderby. Not being Mrs. Grundy, who was Mr. Bounderby?
Why, Mr. Bounderby was as near being Mr. Gradgrind's bosom friend as a man perfectly devoid of sentiment can approach that spiritual relationship towards another man perfectly devoid of sentiment. So near was Mr. Bounderby, or, if the reader should prefer it, so far off. He was a rich man, banker, merchant, manufacturer, and what not, a big, loud man with a stare and a metallic laugh, a man made out of a coarse material which seemed to have been stretched to make so much of him, a man with a great puffed head and forehead, swelled veins in his temples, and such a strained skin to his face that it seemed to hold his eyes open and lift his eyebrows up, a man with a pervading appearance on him of being inflated like a balloon and ready to start, a man who could never sufficiently vaunt himself a self-made man, a man who was always proclaiming, through that brassy speaking trumpet of a voice of his old ignorance and his old poverty, a man who was the bully of humility. A year or two younger than his eminently practical friend, Mr. Bounderby looked older. His 47 or 48 might have had the 7 or 8 added to it again without surprising anybody. He had not much hair. One might have fancied he had talked it off, and that what was left, all standing up in disorder, was in that condition from being constantly blown about by his windy boastfulness. In the formal drawing-room of Stone Lodge, standing on the hearth-rug, warming himself before the fire, Mr. Bounderby delivered some observations to Mrs. Gradgrind on the circumstance of its being his birthday. He stood before the fire, partly because it was a cool spring afternoon, though the sun shone, partly because the shade of Stone Lodge was always haunted by the ghost of damp mortar, partly because he thus took up a commanding position from which to subdue Mrs. Gradgrind.
"I hadn't a shoe to my foot. As to a stocking, I didn't know such a thing by name. I passed the day in a ditch and the night in a pigsty. That's the way I spent my 10th birthday. Not that a ditch was new to me, for I was born in a ditch."
Mrs. Gradgrind, a little, thin, white, pink-eyed bundle of shawls of surpassing feebleness, mental and bodily, who was always taking physic without any effect, and who, whenever she showed a symptom of coming to life, was invariably stunned by some weighty piece of fact tumbling on her. Mrs. Gradgrind hoped it was a dry ditch?
"No, as wet as a sop. A foot of water in it," said Mr. Bounderby.
"Enough to give a baby cold,"
Mrs. Gradgrind considered.
"Cold? I was born with inflammation of the lungs and of everything else, I believe, that was capable of inflammation," returned Mr. Bounderby. "For years, ma'am, I was one of the most miserable little wretches ever seen. I was so sickly that I was always moaning and groaning. I was so ragged and dirty that you wouldn't have touched me with a pair of tongs."
Mrs. Gradgrind faintly looked at the tongs, as the most appropriate thing her imbecility could think of doing.
"How I fought through it, I don't know," said Bounderby. "I was determined, I suppose. I have been a determined character in later life, and I suppose I was then. Here I am, Mrs. Gradgrind, anyhow, and nobody to thank for my being here but myself."
Mrs. Gradgrind meekly and weakly hoped that his mother—
"My mother bolted, ma'am," said Bounderby.
Mrs. Gradgrind, stunned as usual, collapsed and gave it up.
"My mother left me to my grandmother," said Bounderby. "And according to the best of my remembrance, my grandmother was the wickedest and the worst old woman that ever lived. If I got a little pair of shoes by any chance, she would take 'em off and sell them for drink. Why, I have known that grandmother of mine lie in her bed and drink her 14 glasses of liquor before breakfast."
Mrs. Gradgrind, weakly smiling and giving no other sign of vitality, looked, as she always did, like an indifferently executed transparency of a small female figure without enough light behind it.
"She kept a chandler's shop," pursued Bounderby, "and kept me in an egg box. That was the cot of my infancy, an old egg box. As soon as I was big enough to run away, of course, I ran away. Then I became a young vagabond, and instead of one old woman knocking me about and starving me, everybody of all ages knocked me about and starved me. They were right.
They had no business to do anything else. I was a nuisance, an encumbrance, and a pest. I know that very well.
His pride in having at any time of his life achieved such a great social distinction as to be a nuisance, an encumbrance, and a pest was only to be satisfied by three sonorous repetitions of the boast.
I was to pull through it, I suppose, Mrs. Gradgrind. Whether I was to do it or not, ma'am, I did it. I pulled through it, though nobody threw me out a rope. Vagabond, errand boy, vagabond, labourer, porter, clerk, chief manager, small partner, Josiah Bounderby of Coketown. Those are the antecedents and the culmination.
Josiah Bounderby of Coketown learnt his letters from the outsides of the shops, Mrs. Gradgrind, and was first able to tell the time upon a dial plate from studying the steeple clock of St. Giles Church, London, under the direction of a drunken cripple who was a convicted thief and an incorrigible vagrant.
Tell Josiah Bounderby of Coketown of your district schools and your model schools and your training schools and your whole kettle of fish of schools, and Josiah Bounderby of Coketown tells you plainly, all right, all correct, he hadn't such advantages. But let us have hard-headed, solid-fisted people. The education that made him won't do for everybody, he knows well. Such and such his education was, however. And you may force him to swallow boiling fat, but you shall never force him to suppress the facts of his life.
Being heated when he arrived at this climax, Josiah Bounderby of Coketown stopped. He stopped just as his eminently practical friend, still accompanied by the two young culprits, entered the room. His eminently practical friend, on seeing him, stopped also, and gave Louisa a reproachful look that plainly said, "Behold your Bounderby."
"Well," blustered Mr. Bounderby, "what's the matter? What is young Thomas in the dumps about?"
He spoke of young Thomas, but he looked at Louisa. "We were peeping at the circus," muttered Louisa haughtily, without lifting up her eyes, "and Father caught us."
"And Mrs. Gradgrind," said her husband in a lofty manner, "I should as soon have expected to find my children reading poetry."
"Dear me," whimpered Mrs. Gradgrind. "How can you, Louisa and Thomas? I wonder at you. I declare you're enough to make one regret ever having had a family at all. I have a great mind to say I wish I hadn't. Then what would you have done, I should like to know?"
Mr. Gradgrind did not seem favourably impressed by these cogent remarks. He frowned impatiently.
"As if with my head in its present throbbing state, you couldn't go and look at the shells and minerals and things provided for you instead of circuses," said Mrs. Gradgrind. "You know as well as I do, no young people have circus masters or keep circuses in cabinets or attend lectures about circuses. What can you possibly want to know of circuses, then? I'm sure you have enough to do, if that's what you want. With my head in its present state, I couldn't remember the mere names of half the facts you have got to attend to."
"That's the reason," pouted Louisa.
"Don't tell me that's the reason, because it can't be nothing of the sort," said Mrs. Gradgrind. "Go and be something illogical directly."
Mrs. Gradgrind was not a scientific character, and usually dismissed her children to their studies with this general injunction to choose their pursuit. In truth, Mrs. Gradgrind's stock of facts in general was woefully defective. But Mr. Gradgrind, in raising her to her high matrimonial position, had been influenced by two reasons. Firstly, she was most satisfactory as a question of figures, and secondly, she had no nonsense about her. By nonsense, he meant fancy, and truly it is probable she was as free from any alloy of that nature as any human being not arrived at the perfection of an absolute idiot ever was. The simple circumstance of being left alone with her husband and Mr. Bounderby was sufficient to stun this admirable lady again without collision between herself and any other fact. So she once more died away, and nobody minded her.
"Bounderby," said Mr. Gradgrind, drawing a chair to the fireside, "you are always so interested in my young people, particularly in Louisa, that I make no apology for saying to you I am very much vexed by this discovery. I have systematically devoted myself, as you know, to the education of the reason of my family,
The reason is, as you know, the only faculty to which education should be addressed. And yet, Bounderby, it would appear from this unexpected circumstance of today, though in itself a trifling one, as if something had crept into Thomas's and Louisa's minds, which is, or rather, which is not, I don't know that I can express myself better than by saying, which has never been intended to be developed, and in which their reason has no part.
There certainly is no reason in looking with interest at a parcel of vagabonds, returned Bounderby. When I was a vagabond myself, nobody looked with any interest at me, I know that.
Then comes the question, said the eminently practical father, with his eyes on the fire. In what has this vulgar curiosity its rise?
I'll tell you in what. In idle imagination.
I hope not, said the eminently practical. I confess, however, that the misgiving has crossed me on my way home.
In idle imagination, Gradgrind, repeated Bounderby. A very bad thing for anybody, but a cursed bad thing for a girl like Louisa. I should ask Mrs. Gradgrind's pardon for strong expressions, but that she knows very well I am not a refined character. Whoever expects refinement in me will be disappointed. I hadn't a refined bringing up.
Whether, said Gradgrind, pondering with his hands in his pockets and his cavernous eyes on the fire, whether any instructor or servant can have suggested anything, whether Louisa or Thomas can have been reading anything, whether in spite of all precautions any idle storybook can have got into the house, because in minds that have been practically formed by rule and line from the cradle upwards, this is so curious, so incomprehensible.
"Stop a bit," cried Bounderby, who all this time had been standing as before on the hearth, bursting at the very furniture of the room with explosive humility. "You have one of those strollers, children, in the school."
"Cecilia Jupe, by name," said Mr. Gradgrind, with something of a stricken look at his friend.
"Now, stop a bit," cried Bounderby again. "How did she come there?"
"Why, the fact is, I saw the girl myself for the first time only just now. She specially applied here at the house to be admitted as not regularly belonging to our town, and, yes, you are right, Bounderby, you are right."
"Now, stop a bit," cried Bounderby once more. "Louisa saw her when she came?"
"Louisa certainly did see her, for she mentioned the application to me. But Louisa saw her, I have no doubt, in Mrs. Gradgrind's presence."
"Pray, Mrs. Gradgrind," said Bounderby, "what passed?"
"Oh, my poor health," returned Mrs. Gradgrind. "The girl wanted to come to the school, and Mr. Gradgrind wanted girls to come to the school, and Louisa and Thomas both said that the girl wanted to come, and that Mr. Gradgrind wanted girls to come, and how was it possible to contradict them when such was the fact?"
"Now I tell you what, Gradgrind," said Mr. Bounderby. "Turn this girl to the right about, and there's an end of it."
"I am much of your opinion."
"Do it at once," said Bounderby, "has always been my motto from a child. When I thought I would run away from my egg box and my grandmother, I did it at once. Do you the same. Do this at once."
"Are you walking?" asked his friend. "I have the father's address. Perhaps you would not mind walking to town with me."
"Not the least in the world," said Mr. Bounderby, "as long as you do it at once."
So Mr. Bounderby threw on his hat—he always threw it on, as expressing a man who had been far too busily employed in making himself to acquire any fashion of wearing his hat—and, with his hands in his pockets, sauntered out into the hall.
"I never wear gloves," it was his custom to say. "I didn't climb up the ladder in them. Shouldn't be so high up if I had."
Being left to saunter in the hall a minute or two while Mr. Gradgrind went upstairs for the address, he opened the door of the children's study and looked into that serene, floor-clothed apartment, which, notwithstanding its bookcases and its cabinets and its variety of learned and philosophical appliances, had much of the genial aspect of a room devoted to hair-cutting. Louisa languidly leaned upon the window, looking out, without looking at anything, while young Thomas stood sniffing revengefully at the fire. Adam Smith and Malthus, two younger Gradgrinds, were out at lecture in custody, and little Jane, after manufacturing a good deal of moist pipe clay on her face with slate pencil and tears, had fallen asleep over vulgar fractions.
"It's all right now, Louisa. It's all right, young Thomas," said Mr. Bounderby. "You won't do so any more. I'll answer for its being all over with Father. Well, Louisa, that's worth a kiss, isn't it?"
"You can take one, Mr. Bounderby," returned Louisa, when she had coldly paused and slowly walked across the room and ungraciously raised her cheek towards him with her face turned away.
"Always my pet, ain't you, Louisa?" said Mr. Bounderby. "Goodbye, Louisa."
He went his way, but she stood on the same spot, rubbing the cheek he had kissed with her handkerchief until it was burning red. She was still doing this 5 minutes afterwards. "What are you about, Lou?" her brother sulkily remonstrated. "You'll rub a hole in your face." "You may cut the piece out with your penknife if you like, Tom. I wouldn't cry."
Chapter 5. The Keynote. Coketown, to which Messrs. Bounderby and Gradgrind now walked, was a triumph of fact. It had no greater taint of fancy in it than Mrs. Gradgrind herself. Let us strike the keynote, Coketown, before pursuing our tune. It was a town of red brick, or of brick that would have been red if the smoke and ashes had allowed it. But as matters stood, it was a town of unnatural red and black, like the painted face of a savage. It was a town of machinery and tall chimneys, out of which interminable serpents of smoke trailed themselves forever and ever, and never got uncoiled. It had a black canal in it, and a river that ran purple with ill-smelling dye, and vast piles of building full of windows where there was a rattling and a trembling all day long, and where the piston of the steam engine worked monotonously up and down like the head of an elephant in a state of melancholy madness. It contained several large streets all very like one another, and many small streets still more like one another, inhabited by people equally like one another, who all went in and out at the same hours, with the same sound, upon the same pavements, to do the same work, and to whom every day was the same as yesterday and tomorrow, and every year the counterpart of the last and the next. These attributes of Coketown were in the main inseparable from the work by which it was sustained. Against them were to be set off comforts of life which found their way all over the world, and elegancies of life which made, we will not ask how much, of the fine lady who could scarcely bear to hear the place mentioned. The rest of its features were voluntary, and they were these. You saw nothing in Coketown but what was severely workful. If the members of a religious persuasion built a chapel there, as the members of 18 religious persuasions had done, they made it a pious warehouse of red brick, with sometimes, but this is only in highly ornamental examples, a bell in a birdcage on the top of it. The solitary exception was the new church, a stuccoed edifice with a square steeple over the door, terminating in four short pinnacles like florid wooden legs. All the public inscriptions in the town were painted alike in severe characters of black and white. The jail might have been the infirmary might have been the jail, the town hall might have been either or both or anything else, for anything that appeared to the contrary and the graces of their construction. Fact, 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 everywhere in the material aspect of the town, fact, 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 everywhere in the immaterial. The Machocom Child School was all fact, and the School of Design was all fact, and the relations between master and man were all fact, and everything was fact, between the lying-in hospital and the cemetery, and what you couldn't state in figures or show to be purchasable in the cheapest market and saleable in the dearest, was not and never should be, world without end, amen. A town so sacred to fact and so triumphant in its assertion, of course, got on well. Why, no, not quite well. No? Dear me. No. Coketown did not come out of its own furnaces in all respects like gold that had stood the fire. First, the perplexing mystery of the place was, who belonged to the 18 denominations? Because whoever did,
the labouring people did not. It was very strange to walk through the streets on a Sunday morning and note how few of them the barbarous jangling of bells that was driving the sick and nervous mad called away from their own quarter, from their own close rooms, from the corners of their own streets where they lounged listening.